This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. You may not have paid attention to our neighbors to the south, but over the past couple decades, a wave of leftist governments have swept to power across Latin America, what is known as the Pink Tide. This social transformation involved grassroots social movements like the Zapatistas in Chiapas, the Brazilian landless workers, and the Argentinian Picateros, to name a few. It also involved marginalized groups in Latin American society, like landless campesinos, women, indigenous communities, students, LGBT people, and the unemployed. All of this, the authors say, amounted to a rejection of Western-style extractive capitalism and globalization. Well, today on the program, we're airing a talk by Clifton Ross and Marcy Rain, who are the authors of Until the Rulers Obey, Voices from Latin American Social Movements, which was published in January 2014. Their book features interviews with Pink Tide movement participants who share their experiences of resistance and views on the movement's organizational forms and their relation to state power. Marcy Rain and Clifton Ross, who are married, have both researched, participated in, and written widely about progressive social movements in Latin America for the past several decades. They spoke together last week, September 9, 2014, at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. This is Clifton Ross.
You may have gathered by now that we come out of sort of the left traditions, part of this political spectrum. I personally come out of the solidarity movements from the 1980s. I was an Anabaptist in Berkeley, and for those of you who don't know what an Anabaptist is, those are kind of Quaker, Mennonites, traditional peace churches. And I started reading liberation theology and decided I wanted to go off to Nicaragua to find out what was going on in the Sandinista Revolution. And I went down there in 1982 the first time and started investigating more into in liberation theology and became very interested in Latin America. Eventually, I had to go back to school and finish up and do dental work. And so I lost track of what was going on in Latin America. In 2003, I went back to Nicaragua to interview Ernesto Cardenal and Fernando Cardenal. They were both brothers, one of whom was Fernando Cardenal was a minister of education, Sandinista minister of education. And Ernesto Cardenal was a poet and who I translated and worked with through the Sandinista years. And he had been the minister of culture. So I went back to Nicaragua to interview people who had not participated in the piñata. Probably that is only familiar to you in the Latino parties where they have a little piñata that's made out of paper mache. You break it open and the candy spills out and all the kids run and grab little pieces of candy. Well, in Nicaragua, it had a very particular meaning in 1990 when the Sandinistas lost the elections, and that was as a result of a 10-year war that the Reagan administration was waging, and it can only be described as a terrorist war. It was a campaign of terrorizing the civilians, murdering a lot of civilians, very few direct attacks against the Sandinista army, a lot of attacks against daycare centers, health clinics, and delegates of the word, Catholic people who were going around and doing ministering in remote regions of the country were also murdered. And so as a result of that and embargoes and we're talking about Nicaragua, the size of the state of Alabama, about the same military potential as the state of Alabama, too, fighting the United States, which at the time was in the middle of a Cold War, had a huge military, as it does today. So I went back to, so in 1990, when the Sandinistas lost the elections as a result of this war of attrition, they decided to divide up the country and among themselves, the comandantes of the revolution, the commanders of the revolution who had led the process up until that point, divided up the country among themselves, ostensibly to protect the resources for the people of Nicaragua, but they, in the process, became the wealthiest people in the country, which was a real blow to the solidarity movement here in the United States, who had devoted so much of time and energy to defending a revolution which we held have maintained the highest integrity through those years, and then to see it devolve into a piñata where everyone was grabbing what they could before they left office was really quite disturbing. So I went back to Nicaragua in 2004. Marcy joined me. We're just for purposes of disclosure, we're married. She came down and joined me on part of that trip, and we interviewed Fernando Cardinal together. Wonderful. Ernesto and Fernando, both priests, had not participated in the piñata, and we wanted to interview those Sandinistas who had maintained their integrity and their commitment to those high principles of the revolution, which we all admired in the 1980s. So I interviewed Ernesto Cardinal prior to Marcy coming down, and I'd been sort of, I had my head buried in books for a number of years, doing the master's program at San Francisco State and, of all things, to teach ESL. So I was learning about fricatives and things like this, and I don't even remember what the fricative is any longer, but it was really important back then. And I'd gotten completely out of touch with Latin America, and so I asked Ernesto Cardinal, what do you see exciting happening in Latin America today? I said, what about Lula? Lula just won the president of the Workers' Party in Brazil. Oh, no. Ernesto said, not very interesting at all, just kind of another, you know, kind of a moderate, but you should check out Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, he just won in Venezuela, you should go to Venezuela. And so I thought, okay, well, Ernesto's telling me to go to Venezuela, I'm going to Venezuela. So I went to Venezuela, and I became very excited and very enthused by what I was seeing, which was we now know as the beginnings of the Pink Tide. And has anyone heard of the Pink Tide? Okay, a few of you have. The Pink Tide was the turning of the millennium, number of governments moved over to the left, i.e. they became moderately progressive. They left the Washington consensus behind, the neoliberal politics behind, and said, no, there is a role for the state. You know, neoliberalism says we want to shrink the state down. One person described it as until we can drown it. It's become so small we can drown it in the bathtub. In Latin America, people were saying, no, we want to. Well, there's a role for the state. We actually, and there traditionally has always been a role for the state in Latin America. So, and they have a generally positive view of the state in Latin America, despite everything. They began, these progressive governments started coming into power that were giving more benefits to the people. In Venezuela, the oil boom that happened in 2003 as a result of George Bush's war in Iraq, bringing the price of oil from $10 a barrel to $100 a barrel, suddenly left a whole lot of money for Chavez to use spending on social programs called the missions. So I was very excited about this, and I began traveling around through South America and other countries in the Pink Tide, such as Uruguay, where the Frente Amplio, which was a broad left, center-left front, had come to power in 2006. In Bolivia, in 2006, early 2006, Evo Morales came to power with the Movement Towards Socialism Party. Rafael Correa came to power in that I believe it was that year in Ecuador. We saw the FMLN, which had been a guerrilla army, going into electoral politics, win in El Salvador. And the Sandinistas, a very corrupt version of the Sandinistas, but the Sandinistas came back to power in Nicaragua in, I believe it was 2008, if I'm not mistaken. So you have all these center-left governments that were coming into power, and I was very excited and interested in trying to find out what was going on the ground, and I was initially very enthusiastic. A year or two later, in 2008, I met another person who was interested in doing a book on social movements in Latin America, and I thought, oh, that sounds great. So I started working on this project, and then I went back to Latin America interviewing people in the social movements about what was their relationship with these progressive governments. How were they faring on the ground dealing with these progressive governments? Suddenly, a whole new picture began to arise, and one that I couldn't quite put together with what I had thought I was seeing, and suddenly there were I had the experience of what we call cognitive dissonance. The two things were not jibing. What they were, the governments and the supporters were telling us about what they were, and what the social movements were telling us about what they were so different, so dramatically different, that I really couldn't put it together. And eventually, Marcy and I went. The other person dropped out of the book. I invited Marcy to work with me on it because I knew that she was a far better editor than I was, and that she would really work on these stories stories and give them a sense of story. And so we went to Chile together to do some of the final interviews for the book. And then we went from Chile to Argentina to do some more interviews, and then finally to Uruguay to meet with Raul Sebeci, who wrote the foreword to our book. When we got together with Raul in the one morning, we sat down, we were talking. I said, look, Raul, we've got the book pretty much together. We know what's going in there, but now we need to write the introduction. And I'm having really a hard time conceptualizing what we're seeing. I mean, how do these things all fit together? I mean, what do you see as a central problem confronting the social movements in Latin America? In Latin America today is, he said, oh, the progressive governments, the central problem. And I said, could you break that down for me? And he said, yes, these progressive governments have been created in the model of Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank, in his model of the war on poverty. And, you know, you had the war on poverty in the United States, and how did it turn out? You have the government coming in and basically co-opting a lot of the more radical movements, such as the Black Panthers, and a lot of the social movements began to get subsidized by the government, which meant that they had less autonomy. When you're getting a paycheck from someone, you tend to criticize them in public far less than you would if you're not getting a paycheck from them. So we went back and we started working on this and writing the introduction, and I kept thinking, but Venezuela has to be different. No, it's got to be different. This couldn't be what I've been seeing all these years. I'd made a movie about it. It was very positive. It was very critical, but it was very positive. So I had to go back to Venezuela, and I rewrote the introduction to Venezuela to the book several times, and just as I was putting the finishing touches on the eighth or ninth draft or rewrite, I got a phone call from a friend telling me that Chavez had died. So I had to read. I said at that point, I said I've got to go back to Venezuela and write my introduction from there. So I began, when I got to Venezuela, I got there just after the elections, the day after the elections, the border had been closed off. I got there the day after the elections of April, last April, and began to see things in a very different light, because that election had been very close, and Venezuela was suddenly, I was coming into the country, there were shortages already, there were some real severe economic problems, major issues with the country, and they were what are called the Guarimbas, the people who were opposed to the process in Venezuela, blocking the roads. And then there were the Chavistas, who had suddenly begun to use violence to try to put down these demonstrations. We were seeing people on motorcycles chasing armed men on motorcycles in red T-shirts, who were unmistakably Chavistas, going against the opposition. And this was very disturbing for me. I came home and began... I shut myself away for the first 2 months because I was shocked. I had to put this together, and I began studying and reading the people that I hadn't read before, people I hadn't paid attention to. And I finally came out and wrote a piece that was published at a place called counterpunch.org in which I said I publicly withdraw my support from the Bolivarian process. And so then our book came out, and we've had to kind of put all this together, and I've had to try to put together what's going on in Latin America with what was going on throughout the whole 20th century. And given that I've kind of belabored, I've talked a little too much already at this point, I'd like to kind of just in a sentence, and I'll refer you to this, the 20th century is marked by the beginning of the century when the U.S. took over the colonial relations with Latin America from Spain. Up until 1929, it maintained the same relationships of extracting the wealth and bringing it up here where it would be refined. But around the time of the Depression, Latin American governments recognized that they needed to refine those materials themselves, that they would never be able to catch up by just exporting all their wealth. Makes sense. So they began to industrialize more for internal production, internal consumption, and it was called the import substitution industrialization. Raul Prebisch, you can look him up, theorized this. It went well for a while until the 1980s when the debt crisis hit and interest rates went up under Paul Volcker, and these debts suddenly just burgeoned to being completely unmanageable for Latin America, because this was all state-led industrialization with a corporatist political model. I'm assuming a lot of you, since you're probably interested in political science, I can throw these terms around, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, then I'm sure you can look them up later. So this model worked until 1980, and then it collapsed. And people had to default. There was the IMF, the World Bank, and all these people came in to rescue Latin America and sell off all these industries. And Latin America experienced the lost decade of the 80s, during which we had the guerrilla wars in Central America and the military dictatorships in South America to impose this kind of these restrictive policies. And the reaction against it in the guerrilla wars. So come up to the 1990s, and we have the beginnings of globalization, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Sandinista Project, the peace treaties in Central America, the return of democracies to Latin America in the broad sense of the word liberal democracies. The U.S. implemented a policy of democracy promotion, but these didn't work out very well. They were the two-party states, one left, one right, and the left got in power in general because the people voted for people who were going to be favoring them. But those left governments were not able, because of the restrictive policies and the neoliberalism, weren't able to implement very far-reaching reforms, and they were removed very quickly. So at the turn of the millennium, we began to see the pink tide emerge, and they were most all of these governments came out of that breakdown of the two-party state, and a new party, like the Workers' Party, came to power in Brazil, and Chavez came to power with the movement of the Fifth Republic, which he put together for his own presidency, his own presidential bid. These are generally broken down into two different kinds of governments, the left governments of Latin America. One is social democratic. You could call the Workers' Party, that would be Workers' Party, the Frente Amplio in Uruguay, even Bachelet in Chile, and then there are the populist parties. And without getting too much into the whole thing of the populist parties, they tend to be the radical left ones, which is Chavez, Morales in Bolivia, Evo Morales, and Correa, Rafael Correa in Ecuador. Ironically enough, or maybe not so ironically, it fits perfectly with the description that Kenneth Roberts gives of populism, of a process led by a caudillo, a strong man at the top, charismatic strong man who orders from above and ignites a lot of interest in politics at the base and bypasses all the institutions that we think of as the checks and balances on his power, and essentially takes over the state. This is something that Juan Perón did, Getulio Vargas in Brazil, and what we saw with Chavez. These tend to be very much an us and them type of government. So Chavez, anyone who was with him, and you don't criticize the comandante. And those who are opposed to him are all maligned, and they are in Venezuela, they're called the escuálidos, the squalid ones. So this is the context within which the social movements are emerging. In the social democratic states, they're emerging. In the right-wing states, they're emerging. In the left-wing states, they're all coming out of the 60s. They're all coming out of that whole wave in the 60s. But they're all really, really activated by the liberal democratic processes, and they all come out more into the public eye and taking advantage of the freedom of speech and the freedom to assembly and all those things. But this is the context in which they find themselves. They are as they criticize, and as they because they are critical, they are internally diverse, but they're unified in purpose. So they have a lot of different perspectives on the world. There are a lot of different religions, a lot of different philosophies and so forth, but they're united in their purpose of, for instance, to stop drilling on indigenous land in Ecuador, or to stop mining in Peru. As they emerge, they have been increasingly coming into conflict with governments of the right and the left. It doesn't really matter, because all these governments in this new period have left behind ISI, the import substitution industrialization, and they are now in the process of neo-extractivism. And neo-extractivism, how is it different from extractivism of the early 20th century and up to the beginnings of the 20th century? It's different in this regard. The main extractor in Latin America today is now our communist brothers in China. That's how it's being framed. And as it's being framed as our comrades and our allies in China in the building of socialism, in the socialism of the 21st century, which is how it's being framed in Venezuela and Ecuador and Bolivia, this is our way to development. But this neo-extractivism is essentially the same thing. It's taking the wealth out of the country, and the money is going to fund poverty programs, which is the positive side of it, but it's not going to develop anything at all in the country. So that when the wealth is gone, all that's left behind are poison streams, poisoned lakes from the arsenic, from the mining, the open pits, the degraded forests, and so that's what Latin America will be left with. The poverty will be far worse after this round of extractivism.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Clifton Ross is the co-author of Until the Rulers Obey, Voices from Latin American Social Movements, a book published this year that examines the pink tide and various leftist social movements that came to power across Latin America these past couple decades. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, we're airing a talk by authors Clifton Ross and Marcy Rain, two activists and authors who researched and wrote the book Until the Rulers Obey, Voices from Latin American Social Movements. The book features interviews with movement leaders and activists from different South American countries to understand their unique motivations and perspectives on this broad-based social movement. Next, Marcy Rain moved to the podium.
So just to segue a little bit, I think what became very clear to us as we edited and worked with the material that we had compiled for the book that was that we weren't going to see really radical changes coming out of these pink tide governments, however hopeful we had been about them, that it was really the independent and critical social movements who would be the key force for radical social change. And they were the ones who were going to deepen and extend any kind of radical process and bring some alternative visions into being. So there's a couple of ways in which they did this. One, which Cliff alluded to, and I won't elaborate a whole lot, is that there were very many movements in opposition to this neo-extractivism, really coming out of the fact that the, as you've heard, that the mining and the industrial agriculture was just shredding the fabric of people's communities, polluting their water sources, was making it impossible for them to continue their traditional ways of life. And then in the case of very many indigenous activists and communities in South America, it was just an affront to their entire way of seeing the world, which is, I think, not so different from now with our greater consciousness about the environment in some places, but different from the 20th century idea of socialist progress that many of these governments worked with, which was really about modernization, progress, distributing resources from people, even if it meant gutting the earth to do so. So one key dynamic in these social movements is resistance to extractivism. And another way in which they bring alternative visions into being is by creating new spaces, by occupations of all kinds. And yes, I think somewhat akin perhaps to Occupy here, but we're looking at mass nonviolent direct actions by people who are motivated by sheer survival needs to take over housing so they have places to live, to take over land so they can farm and live, to take over factories so they have places to work. And there are a few key characteristics of these. One is this thing of the idea of occupying a territory. whether it's land, work, or living space. And this can be from very small territories. One of the groups in the book was a community center in a working class neighborhood of Uruguay called the Galpón de Corales, and they had a cafe and a micro radio station, and they were starting a recycling cooperative so people could have work. Very small community level, with people insisting that they had to live in the community where they worked for that to be really valid organizing, all the way up to the level of the MST, the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, which has taken over an area of the country, an area of Brazil that's as large as the entire country of Uruguay. And people have squatted in encampments, they've made their settlements, they've started farms, they've started their own schools and a whole set of parallel institutions. So the MST, also the Zapatistas in the state of Chiapas in Mexico. So these are territoriality from small to big. They're also, we talked about taking over land, taking over housing. The other big takeover movement was the recuperation of factories, particularly in Argentina after the economic collapse. I don't know if any of you have had occasion to see the film The Take, but it's a really visually stunning and very fascinating political film by Avi Klein and Naomi Lewis about the recuperated factories in Argentina. And one of the people who appeared in that movie is also in our book, an organizer by the name of Lalo Perret. And you know, he talks about this aspect of being motivated by necessity, and he puts it very simply. He talks about factory occupations. This model of not having a boss wasn't optional. It was just the best they could do. I think the greatest experience this collective has gained is the possibility of knowing that despite any situation of crisis or abuse from employers, organized workers can perform a productive process with these market rules, the rules of capitalism. And he goes on to say later on that this is really a great experience for workers all over the world, that we don't need a boss to work and to make things run. So Lalo talked about, you know, solutions derived from necessity. And I think the final point, so we have territoriality, we have necessity, and the final thing that is very interesting to me, at least, about these kinds of organizing is that they're really trying to find different ways of running themselves, alternative forms of governance. So they work on making decisions by direct participatory democracy, by everybody having a say, and you know, working from the bottom up, and they see this as a very key part of accomplishing their goal. And the MST speaks to this, because as large as they are, they still work on this bottom-up participatory model. So we have an interview with Anna Hanauer from the MST, and she says, we begin with one important principle, which is participation. In both the encampments and the settlements, we organize the people in base nuclei made up of 20 to 30 families each. The coordination of the encampments and settlements is made up of the coordinators of the base nuclei. All the decisions that the movement is going to make are discussed at the base. You always have to appear the opinion of the nuclei, because that's the space everyone has to give their opinions to participate. It's a philosophy. People are only subjects in the history of their movement and their own history if they participate, if they give their opinion. Now, I think there are very many more examples in the book, but I think that rather than run through them right now, I think we might stop and have some discussion, unless Cliff has something to add. And you know, I can tell you more stories. There are indeed very many stories in this book, but we've already thrown a lot at you. So you know, any comments, observations, questions you have, please, we invite you to ask.
So my name's Chris Jensen. I'm a graduate student, and I'm studying collective action in Latin America. I wanted to know a little bit, and you kind of hinted at it, but what the implications were for the institutionalization or the incorporation of some of these social movements into the formal governing structure. So I was kind of thinking of some of the changes with Bachelet getting reelected in Chile, the student movement, and if it's really going to result in co-optation, or I know that some of the student leaders actually got elected to Congress, and they're also now including the Communist Party into the leftist coalition, which hasn't been done for many years. So if you could speak to that, that'd be great.
Well, I'll start this off, and then Cliff will chime in. I think one really interesting place to study this is actually in Ecuador, and I would recommend to you for your reading group almost anything by Mark Becker, who did the introduction to Ecuador in our book and is a very knowledgeable scholar of the region. And he followed the experience of several indigenous movements there who got involved deeply in electoral politics, even forming an indigenous party called Pachacutic, and working very hard for the election of Lucio Gutierrez in 2003, around there. But Gutierrez was running on a platform that seemed very consistent with their interests, but once he got in, he turned. And they had spent a whole lot of political capital, the folks who had set up Pachacutic, on this effort to get him elected, and they really and a lot of their good people had gone into this process, so they were really they were decimated by this. So one of the lessons that the other this was one wing of, there were a lot of different organizations, and another group, which was a network of indigenous and peasant and black organizations called FENOCIN, they drew a different lesson, which is to stand outside, to be supportive, not to put your best people in, not to get your program completely tied up with that of the government, but to maintain autonomy so you have the space to be critical. And I think that was a lesson that we saw in a lot of different places, is the need for autonomy. So it's not that you don't engage with the governments and with these electoral processes, but that the social movements have learned that, the government has its tasks, and the social movements have theirs, and the social movements forget that. Same thing in Paraguay, actually. Very interesting comment in the book. In Paraguay in 2008, Fernando Lugo was elected as the president. He had been, they called him the Red Bishop. He had been, in the Catholic Church and resigned to run for political office. And the social movement organizations again mobilized behind him. They did consultations all over the country to help build his program. Once he was in office, they found that he was under tremendous attack by the right wing, eventually deposed in a parliamentary coup in 2012. But the social movements in Paraguay found that all of their work was going into defending him. And as one of our interviewees said, they abandoned their historical fighting tools because, if we attack him, we'll end up with the right wing. So those are a couple of examples. Cliff probably has more.
Yeah, does that sound familiar? There's a book by Kurt Wayland who called The Leftist Governments of Latin America, which I'm reading, and he's really interesting. I mean, of course, I come out of the extreme far left, and I've moderated. I'm much older now, much older and wiser, and I've moderated quite a bit. And he said something that I think is very sensible. Now, if you ask Raul, he's going to say that in Uruguay, there are no social movements. He says that in the introduction. By the way, each one of the chapters is introduced by a different authority on that country, and he introduced the chapter on Uruguay. He says there are no social movements in Uruguay. I think that's probably an exaggeration, but what he's saying is that a lot of these social movements have put their people in the government, and now they've been essentially co-opted in that regard, if you want to call it that. Someone reminded me at another talk that I gave in New Mexico that, well, aren't the social movements getting something out of that, in that co-optation? Well, yes, they are. And Pachacutic got something out of it, too, briefly. But they also lost, major ground, and they're only just now beginning to rebuild. But I think what Kurt Whalen points out is that the radical movements have far less chance of establishing long-term gains than the moderate ones, where they've been able to dialogue and bring different sectors of society in. You could say co-opt certain sectors and bring them along. But those points of view also are having a co-opting effect on the government, so that the government is now having to pay a little bit more attention to the social movement's point of view to some degree. Maybe only a little bit, but a little bit. And those gains, the society is going to maintain more likely than if the changes are radical and they're done by one leader and the people haven't bought in. I mean, I think the best example is Venezuela, where you have the referendum of 2007, the first election that Chavez lost, and he was trying to establish socialism. Then he went around the Constitution and went around the referendum and went ahead and did it anyway, all of the things that the people had voted against. How long is that going to last? Well, probably not much past Maduro, if Maduro lasts, and there's a big question about that. So, I don't know. I think it's a very complicated thing, and in every situation, we're going to see something different, and I don't know.
That's author and activist Clifton Ross, along with Marcy Rain, answering questions from students at the University of Utah last week. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Until the Rulers Obey, Voices from Latin American Social Movements, is a book published earlier this year and written by Clifton Ross and Marcy Rain, who both spoke last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Their book brings together voices from the movements that widely changed Latin American politics at the turn of the 21st century. As Ross and Rain describe, the movements galvanized long-silent groups in South American society, including indigenous people, campesinos, students, and the LGBT community. And the movements all found different approaches to winning popular support. They answered questions from students on September 9, 2014.
Hi, my name is Charlie McPherson. I study ESL, Spanish and Arabic here. And I just had a question about what you thought would happen to countries where the pink tide did not put in governments, like Colombia and Argentina, especially with the drug war beginning to end in Colombia, but then in the burgeoning economy right next to massive inequality. Same thing with Argentina, political corruption and bankruptcy. What do you see as the future of what we might call moderate states in South America, and how do you envision their progress? And, you know, is Argentina or Colombia ripe for a revolution, or is it not?
Well, I have a strong opinion about that, but I want to know what a fricative is first. Well, actually, you know, what's interesting is that when I go back and forth, when I went back and forth to Colombia and Venezuela, I would go overland, I would fly into Bogota, and then I would either take buses or fly into Cucuta, and then I would go over to Venezuela, because that was my route. And coming back the same way. What is interesting is that the living standards in Colombia have increasingly gone up, and in Venezuela, where oil is the number one cash export, the living standard has gone down. And that is, Venezuela is supposedly having a revolution, and Colombia is supposedly this horrible right-wing place. And I don't know what to think any longer about what right and left mean. I don't even know what revolution means in the 21st century. We don't, you know, if the FARC is a part of a revolution, I want to have nothing at all to do with them. So the questions are really, you know, really big. Are they ripe for revolution? They're ripe for something. I don't know what they're ripe for. But I think that what we're seeing in Colombia is much more independent, autonomous, critical social movement activity than we have seen in Venezuela under the Chavista period. Now, Chavez was able to mobilize masses of people because it was a populist project. And this is the nature of populist projects. This is the thing that I didn't understand when I first went to Venezuela, what populism was. That's what I've been studying over the past year. I've been really, really trying to educate myself about what populism is. And if you want to understand Venezuela, read Kenneth Roberts about populism, and then go over there and look at what you're seeing in Venezuela and tell me if you don't think it's a populist project. So a revolution, I'd say a populist project. Socialism, not even close. Populist project. In in Colombia, people have called Uribe a populist of the right wing, and then there was Fujimori, who was a right-wing populist. That might be true, but all I can say is that in general, the social movement activity in Colombia is extraordinary. It's extraordinarily diverse and rich, and I was just coming back through in November of last year, stopped in Bogota, saw a friend of mine, and we were sitting in this cafe, and she was talking about, and then that Uribe, and then, you know, we were talking politics in a cafe, and she said, and Cliff, look at this. And I said, yeah. She said, yeah. Remember last time you came through here? We would never have had a political conversation in a cafe in Colombia. Never. Not allowed. Not in anything other than a whisper. And now we're talking aloud and everybody's just kind of walking around like everything's normal. So there's something going on. I'm hoping personally, and this is just my own view, is that I hope that we're going to be able to build, if we are going to build something of socialism in the future, it's going to be based on the liberal democratic rights that we have in our world, that we're going to be able to extend those rights into the social realm and recognize that not only do we have individual rights, we have social rights, rather than saying we're you know, as the populists have done, that feeling that it's okay to eliminate social rights, I mean, individual rights like the freedom of the press, as is happening in Venezuela today, and the freedom to assemble and freedom to speak out, as is happening, probably, I would argue, even in my country. But to extend those rights. So that's kind of, and that's what I would hope would be the revolution of the 21st century, if we have one. And hopefully nobody will have to pick up any guns to do it.
I have a question for you. For those of us living in North America, what is key to understanding Latin America? I mean, there's quite a different cultural divide. There's quite a cultural divide between the two. So what's key to understanding Latin America as a North American?
You know, it's a huge, I mean, it's just huge and very complicated, and there are individual dynamics in each country. I think that's why when we were putting the book together, we decided that to even make the interviews make sense, we would need to give some context, and we weren't going to be able to know enough to do that. So we searched out experts like Mark Becker for Ecuador, like Mario Murillo, who wrote about Colombia, Raul Zubechi in Uruguay, and various other people, just to give some sense, because each country has its own history, each country has its own patterns of colonization. Each country has a different mix of people, you know, different political economy. So I think as I look at it, and I've done, you know, some study and a lot of traveling with Cliff, but my grounding is social movements here. I think that's what I come away with, is just, you know, a healthy respect for the diversity and difference. And I think it does help me to ground in the very basic dynamics of the colonial history, and there's some you know, very basic and good writings on that. Eduardo Galeano, although he's somewhat rethought what he wrote, but The Open Veins of Latin America, which really talks about the beginning of extractivism in incredibly powerful terms there. Greg Grandin on Empire's workshop about U.S. relations to Latin America. So these are, you know, understanding that history, I think, gives some framework also.
You remember what Ronald Reagan said when he came back from Latin America? Well, those are all different countries down there.
Yeah.
Well, that's something I thought, well, there you go. What a great little bit of advice.
Yeah, kind of what I said.
Yeah, it is,
but
exactly.
A little shorter.
Hello, my name is Dane, and I'm an undergrad student here studying parks, recreation, and tourism. And my question for you is, what are the differences in the social movements here in America compared to Latin America? I know there's the major differences in social class and how our countries operate, but when you get down to the framework of how our social movements in the United States operate and their intricacies, do you see, what are the similarities and differences between how they operate down in Latin America?
You know, I think I just referred to the fact that Latin Americans are much less skeptical of their governments, even though they've gone through dictatorships that disappeared huge numbers of people and so forth and so on. There is a corporatist view of the world that is there and that is present in most countries of Latin America from Roman Catholicism. You know, if you think of the impact of Protestantism on our culture and Puritanism in particular, the idea of individual salvation, the fact that, you know, the absence of any kind of a social cohesive sensibility in our country. I mean, I think probably in Utah we might be talking about something quite distinct, but in the rest of the United United States, it's very definitely the Puritan Protestantism has made a distinct impact on our thinking. And so Latin American social movements are far, far less individualistic. And I'll give you just a quick example from Venezuela. I was going through the jungles with two Yucpa guides and a friend of mine, a filmmaker. We were in investigating something in the Yucpa area. And at a certain point, I just said, "Hey, look, I'm a little bit older than you. I'm going to just stop here and rest for a few minutes. You guys go on up ahead." And they all looked at me like I was crazy, and they all sat down next to me, and they just started making jokes. And I'm like, "No, go on ahead." And they're like looking at me like, "What are you saying?" I mean, they didn't even get it. I mean, this is so completely the clash of cultures. In Latin American social movements, there's not the idea that we're going to leave anyone behind. They're just not the idea there. I think the social movements there have much more cohesion. I think they're. I think just across the board, you get that sensibility. I think that there's not such an aversity to having leaders and people in charge and delegating authority to people. That's my take.
See, I would say rather the opposite on that, but okay. I had to stop.
You're married.
You know, a lot of the book gets theorized over the kitchen table. But I think that was a great question, and it kind of gave me pause. And I think one thing that I always notice and appreciate when I'm talking to people in Latin American social movements is the influence of the popular education movement and the theories of Paulo Freire, and which really, in a nutshell, work from people's own experience, having people look at their experience, having understand how their individual experience expresses a social reality, and then using that as the basis for mobilization. And there's one of the interviews in here with an activist from Venezuela, Maria Vicenta Davila, talks about that in very interesting ways, and how the popular education committees in this very rural area in the mountains of Venezuela went on to do all kinds of community improvement projects, having, you know, gotten this basic sort of understanding of themselves as subjects in history. Because I think any kind of organizing, that's where it starts, is it starts with our own basic learning that we can make a difference, learning that we're shaped by our social and political context, that our actions can make a difference, and then trying to understand what those forces are that have impacted us and how we can impact them. And I think that there's a greater general level of that kind of approach in the Latin American social movements, the consciousness formation, and then also political formation, where groups who are not only gathered to do specific activities, but also studying political theory together and political concepts. They place a very high value on that kind of education and formation. And with that, also an understanding of history, an understanding of their own cultural and radical historical traditions that can inform what they're doing today, which I think for us also is extremely valuable, because there's a lot of collective action tradition even in this country, but that we have to really dig at, you know, maybe in our own experience of our own families, or maybe, you know, in reading the history. But we have legacy also that we can capture that can inform what we're doing now.
Okay, hi. My name is Mo. Undergrad student here, political science with an emphasis in international politics. My question is more directed towards Marcy. What do you see in Latin America, the role of women in these social movements are? And have you had personal experience accompanying your husband into these Latin American countries where these political leaders or political social movement people, like, how have they seen you in the role as, you know, being a woman so involved in these in this kind of field?
There's a number of interviews with women activists in the book, and I think in a lot of cases, they're playing instrumental roles in the community activism. So, for example, in the fights against mining and resource extraction, in the MST, they have very specific guidelines for the participation of women. We also talked to some very interesting interviews with women in Nicaragua and commentary on the Sandinista government's very anti-woman policy. They're one of the few countries in the world that absolutely ban abortion. And women who have fought against this have been criminalized, been brought up on charges, and eventually got off, but a lot of work. So there's some very, very varied experiences. And some of that, the other part of your question is a little hard to answer because I am not as fluent in Spanish. I speak some, but so my ability to express myself as a political activist is not quite what it would be if we were here. But we were together at the Social Forum of the Americas in Caracas in 2006, which is part of that year they decided to do the World Social Forum decentralized. So this was the Forum of the Americas. And there was a whole labor track of discussions. And that was really eye-opening, and a lot of discussions, people actually mostly around the Americas but some all over the world, and in that sense very equal participation from people with all different levels of politics and whatnot. So
well, I'll just mention that the women tend to take the leading role in confrontations with the state, so that in one of the places in Ichimbia, one of the communities in Ecuador, the women were out front. They tend to do this. They tend to put the women and children out front to face off with the National Guard, because the National Guard is much less likely to attack the women. But you can imagine the kind of courage it takes for children and for women to go out in front and face down the National Guard, who are all in armor. And so, pretty incredible.
That's Marcy Rain and Clifton Ross, authors of the book Until the Rulers Obey, Voices from Latin American Social Movements, who spoke last week at the University of Utah. You've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. You can hear this recorded talk again on KCPW's website and follow this program on Twitter at @KCPWHinckley. Join us every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW.